John 18, verse 33. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, "I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" They cried out again, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber.
Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified.
Great, thanks very much, guys. Do keep your Bibles open at that passage. We aren't going to refer to it immediately, but we will get around to talking about it in a few minutes' time, so if you keep a finger in it, that would be very helpful. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Dave Crofts, and I help out with the youth and the student work here at Christchurch Central, and it's great to be able to add my welcome to Matt's already this afternoon. As Matt's already said, here at Christchurch Central, we believe that it's really, really important to make sure that Christianity is engaging with contemporary culture and with the world around us. And that's why we've got these two Culture Explored sessions. And that's why we're going to be spending the next 25 minutes or so thinking about one of the world's big isms, that being secularism. It is a really big subject, so I'm afraid we're only going to get to the tip of the iceberg this afternoon. But I'm not too worried about that, because hopefully there'll be plenty of food for thought that will mean that you'll be able to go home tonight and discuss it with other people or the friends you've come along with, maybe even just down the pub afterwards. There is a bit of a risk, I think, that when we're doing these ism slots, we get a little bit too theoretical, a bit kind of thinky. But I think actually we'll get much more out of them if we try to bring them down to a practical day-to-day level. And that's going to be my aim this afternoon. We will have to cover a bit of theory, I'm afraid, but we'll end up, I hope, understanding the practical implications of secularism what it is, how we should respond to it, whether we're Christians here this afternoon, or whether we're non-Christians who are just thinking through Christian stuff and weighing up whether there's anything in it. So what we're basically going to do, just to give you an overview, is we're going to start by thinking about what secularism is. Then we're going to think about what secularism means, so what its consequences are for the way that we think and the way that we live. And finally, we're going to think about what the Bible has to say to the secular mindset, how secularism interacts with the Christian message, the gospel. So it will, as I say, be a little while before we get around to that passage that Mark and Lil read for us, but we will get there. But before we start thinking about secularism, what it is and what it means for society and the church, I want to play you a little piece of music just for a minute and a half or so. Just sit and listen to this, listen to the words that are being sung, and I guess do what the guy who's singing them is telling you, cue music. I'm sure most of you will recognise that song. That was Imagine by the former Beatle John Lennon. It's a song in which Lennon dreams of a utopia, a paradise, where there is no religion, and everyone lives in peace and harmony as one. It's not a song about secularism as such, but I think it is an interesting starting point because it does reflect some secular thought and some of the aims of secularism as a movement. Imagine no religion. All the people living life in peace. But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Before I go much further, it'd be worth stopping, wouldn't it? And making sure that we know exactly what we're talking about when we talk about secularism. So, what is secularism? Here's a dictionary definition for you. Secularism, noun, a doctrine that rejects religion or religious considerations. Now, I'm not about to rewrite the dictionary, another time maybe. But I'm not convinced that that's necessarily a very helpful definition. I think if we want to get a handle on what secularism is and what it means, we'd do better to look at what the BBC website says about it. Here it is, bbc.co.uk. I'm guessing that most of you can't read that because the print is tiny, so I'll read you a couple of extracts. It says there on the BBC website that secularists oppose religion or the religious being afforded privileges, which put another way means others are disadvantaged. Secularists are not against the right of individuals to have a religious faith. What they oppose is special treatment for religious beliefs and organisations. So that means that secularism is different from atheism. People often think that they're kind of the same thing, but they're not really. Atheism says there is no God. Secularism says, well, there may or there may not be a God, and you may or may not believe in him, but faith in God must not give you special privileges. So atheism says God is non-existent, Secularism says, when it comes to public life anyway, God is irrelevant. We must remove religion from matters of government policy and from law so that people of all faiths are treated equally. To quote John Lennon again, to imagine all the people living life in peace and the world will live as one. And that sounds quite positive and healthy, doesn't it? I mean, the idea that people of all faiths are treated equally in society is a very commendable one. I think it's important for us all to understand that, like a lot of isms, secularism actually starts off with some very noble aims. I've been doing some reading on my secularist literature. Thankfully, Ollie Bugden, one of our students, did a dissertation on it, and he was able to send me some helpful articles. And he sent me one by a secularist philosopher called Julian Baggini, who I'd never heard of before, but now I have, and so have you. And he was able to say this. Secular neutrality with regards to belief is what stands between us and a society which is even more divided than it already is by religious beliefs. This surely is in the interest of everyone, believers and non-believers. If you believe in a compassionate God who values humanity's ability to choose beliefs for itself, then the conclusion should be obvious. God would be a secularist too. Controversial, eh? Christians do believe in a compassionate God who values humanity's ability to choose beliefs for itself. So, should we agree with Mr. Baggini? Is God a secularist? Well, no, I don't think he is. You see, the problem is, traditional secularism, in the form that we're talking about, is unable to deliver the equality that it aims at. And even the secularists recognise this. I'll go back to Julian Baggini one last time. He says, excluding religion from the public sphere fails to fully respect religious beliefs and their importance in people's lives. Furthermore, it privileges a certain atheistic, liberal worldview which is not widely shared. Secularism is not, as it is claimed to be, neutral with regards to belief. Rather, it robs the genuinely religious of the right to publicly assert their belief, and it therefore privileges godless liberalism over other belief systems. It is not neutral to ideology, but is just another ideology being imposed. There's some good long words in there. Good news if you like long words, but if you don't, what Julian Baggini is basically saying is that actually if we leave religion out of public life, we're discriminating against believers. So if I'm an atheist, I'm quite happy for religion to be squeezed out of public life. It's not really going to do me any harm at all. But if I'm a Christian, or a Muslim, or a Jew, or a Hindu, or a Sikh, or a Buddhist for that matter, I'll probably be quite unhappy with the process of secularism. Atheism and secularism may not be the same thing, but they are very close friends. And that's why this guy, Julian Baggini, is arguing that secularists need to sit down and rethink the concept of secularism so that it can give freedom of expression to religion without actually favouring the religious. He still thinks that secularism will get there in the end. It just needs to be changed. I, however, am not so convinced. So hopefully that's helped us get a handle on what secularism is, a bit of theory, if you like. It's basically the exclusion of religion from matters of public life, from law, government policy, systems of education, etc., etc. So a secularist would probably be against faith schools, or against the fact that the Church of England is tied very closely to the state, to the government. But what I think is particularly interesting about secularism is that it's one of the few isms that also has an ization. Let me explain what I mean by that, because that probably is quite cryptic. You see, as well as talking about secularism, we can also talk about secularisation. And you can't do that with a lot of isms. Atheism is a word. Atheisation is not. If you try and play that against me in a game of Scrabble, I will tell you to get lost. Hedonism is a word. Hedonisation, even though it would be a great Scrabble score, is not. And the reason for that is that, as well as being a belief system, a worldview, an ideology, if you want to use the posh word, secularism has a process kind of angle to it as well. Secularisation. And that's the process by which a society gets more and more secular, by which religion is increasingly marginalised, it's pushed to the edges. So secularism, it's not just a set of beliefs. It actually has this process aspect to it, an observable trend. And it's a process that has been well documented in this country. A 2003 poll by the Murray Research Agency found that only 17% of people in the UK consider religion to be a significant factor in their lives, and that's a figure that would have been substantially higher in the past. In fact, when considering sources of inspiration, close friends and a walk in the country both rank significantly higher than Jesus Christ in the poll. Whilst both Nelson Mandela and Princess Diana were more inspirational to people than a sacred text, for example, the Bible or the Quran, traditional forms of religion do seem to be in decline, at least in the UK. The Christian Church has done its own alarming research into these trends, discovering that between 1998 and 2005, a period of only 7 years, 500,000 people stopped going to church on Sundays. That's most of the population of Sheffield. And since nearly a third of all churchgoers are aged 65 or over, the decline looks set to continue as older generations die off and no new younger people come in to take their place. The rise of secularism in the UK, in the whole of Western Europe in fact, is hard to dispute, and religious groups, and not just Christians, are finding themselves marginalised in legislation, in the media, in society in general. And the key point is that for that secularisation to take place, it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has to have a thorough grasp of the theory behind secularism. If I think about most of my friends, people who I've spent time with this weekend for instance, most of them wouldn't call themselves secularists. They aren't philosophical secularists as such, but they are practical secularists. They aren't too fussed about the disestablishment of the Church of England. They don't really have strong views on faith schools, but they do live as if God is irrelevant. They live as if life can best be lived without reference to God. They've pushed God to the edges of their lives, and that makes them practical secularists. And that's the sort of secularism that we encounter on a day-to-day basis when we step outside. That's the secularism that shapes the world in which we live, that makes it hard for guys like Nathan to be able to be open and honest about sharing our faith. And that's the secularism that means that whilst membership of the National Secular Society represents a pretty tiny percentage of the population, Christian commentators have been saying for some years that secularism has triumphed. But what does that triumph mean for the world we live in? What are the consequences of secularism? Well, secularism has a number of consequences, and what I want to do is just pick out three of them for analysis in a bit more detail, and then think about a Christian response to each of those three. Here's the first consequence of secularism. Secularism makes faith private. It says, okay, you can have your faith, just keep it to yourself. Religious groups are denied a public platform because, well, that would be giving them an unfair privilege. And politicians are criticised if they start to describe or to justify policy decisions in terms of personal faith. There was a slightly ridiculous case in the news last year, I'm not sure if you remember it, of a British Airways employee who was told that she couldn't wear a cross to work because it was a religious symbol. And that's an extreme case of this consequence of secularism, the fact that it makes faith private. Effectively, what BA was saying to that employee was that she could express her faith in what she wore at home, that's not a problem, but not at work. That faith had to be private. There's a theologian called David Wells who has put this in some nice long words, which I find tremendously satisfying. If you're not like me, you can zone out for a minute. He said this: secularism strips life of the divine, but it's important to see that it does so by relocating the divine in that part of life which is private. Basically, it takes our faith, secularism, and it says, no, you can't have it in the public part of your life. Faith is for the private bit of your life. And that's something we encounter on a daily basis. It's something that makes it hard for Christians to share their faith or to talk openly about it, because faith is supposed to be a private matter. And it means that because faith is so often behind closed doors, more and more people know less and less about what Christianity really is, because they're just not confronted with it. So secularism makes faith private. That's one of its consequences. Here's the second one I want us to think about. Secularism makes truth personal. It makes truth personal. There's another ism that could be used to describe this, and that's relativism. And it kind of follows on from the first consequence. Because if my faith becomes something that's private, something that's my own personal interest, then the things it says are true become personal as well. My truth is, well, it's my truth, and that's my business. Your truth is yours, and that's your business. If we want to talk about them, well, okay, we can. But I can't force my personal truth into your personal space. What's true for me may or may not be true for you. Truth has become relative rather than absolute. You see, secularism says that we should base our public life, our shared life, on shared truth, on only the things that we know we have in common. And into that category, what secularism puts is scientific knowledge about the physical universe. So the dominance of this secular scientific view of life has meant that people have come to believe that scientific knowledge is the only true kind of knowledge, and that the physical universe is all that there is. And that means that it's actually impossible to speak about religious and ethical knowledge as such. Instead, religious and ethical views are nothing more than personal opinions, like your preferred musical artist or your favourite flavour of ice cream. They don't qualify as hard knowledge. And as a result, in discussing religious and moral questions, no one's right or wrong, and everyone's opinion's equal. Truth has become personal. There are no absolutes. And that means that you're intolerant if you say that other people's views about morality or about God are wrong. So one of the main implications of secularism has been that it's become unacceptable to talk in terms of absolute morality or exclusive religion, terms like those claimed by Christianity. So secularism makes faith private and it makes truth personal, and there's one more consequence of secularism I want to briefly identify before we come up with a Christian response, and it's this. Secularism puts man on the throne. It puts man on the throne. Because it removes God from the picture, secularism ends up with man ruling man on man's terms. To the secularist, that's probably not a problem. In fact, having man ruling man on man's terms probably sounds like the sort of paradise that John Lennon would be inspired to write a song about. And if that's true of secularism on a social and a political level, it's equally true of the sort of practical, everyday secularism that we were talking about earlier, the sort of secularism that's extremely common in our culture. You see, if secularism ultimately says God is irrelevant, it must come up with some other authority by which to run things. And for most people, what fills that gap is self. The practical secularist is taking charge of his or her own life, putting him or herself on the throne. We could give this consequence an ism label too if we wanted. It's humanism. Secularism says at its outset that people are free to believe in whatever faith they want as long as they keep it to themselves. But in practice, it ends up encouraging humanism. It puts man on the throne. It says that actually we know best, that we can and should run our lives our own way without necessarily needing to refer to God all the time. So those are three consequences of secularism. It makes faith private, it makes truth personal, and it puts man on the throne. But what does the Bible say about all this? This is a really important question to be asking. If you're a Christian, it's an important question because, well, we live in a secular culture and we're trying to reach a secular culture with the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. And if you're not a Christian, well, it's still an important question because you get to see if Christianity still works in the face of secularism. So this is the bit of the talk where we're going to get practical and where we're going to get biblical. Let's look at each consequence in turn. Firstly, in response to the fact that secularism makes faith private, I want to say this. The gospel makes faith our identity, not just our activity. The gospel makes faith our identity, not just our activity. Let me explain what I mean by that. I think that one of the reasons that secularism has crept into a position of dominance in our society is that Christians have let our faith become our activity rather than our identity. We've let it become what we do, not who we are. And it's easy, isn't it, to privatise what we do. For instance, I'm a very keen player of the rather obscure sport of ultimate frisbee. Here's a nice picture of some people playing frisbee. It is a great sport, as I'm sure you'll be able to tell from that picture. But at the end of the day, it's just a hobby. It's something I do. And because it's what I do rather than who I am, I can do it behind closed doors, metaphorically speaking anyway. There probably wouldn't be space to literally do it behind closed doors. In any case, I can do it as a private part of my life, with people who share the same interests. And for people who aren't interested, well, sure, I might go on about it a bit from time to time, but I'm not forcing it on anyone. My relationships with people who don't play frisbee aren't greatly affected by the fact that I do play frisbee, because it's just something I do. It's not who I am. But the Christian message, the gospel, defines my identity. It's much, much more than just a hobby. There are plenty of bits of the Bible that we could go to demonstrate this. I just want to give you a few verses that show that the gospel makes faith our identity, not just our activity. And these are going to appear on the screen for you. Here's the first one. This is from the church leader Paul, who's writing to a church in a town called Galatia, and he says this: I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. What Jesus has done for Paul has transformed his identity, so much so that he's actually saying there that the person that he was has been crucified with Jesus. And the person he is now, the life that he lives now, is defined by his relationship with Jesus. Faith is not for Paul something he does, it's someone he is. He makes the same point when he's writing a letter to the Colossian church. He says there, set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth, for you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Your life, your identity, is with Christ. And when he's writing to the church in Rome, he tells the Christians there, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. See, the gospel, the Christian message, transforms who we are. And that can't be a private matter, can it? I can't keep who I am to myself, not if I'm to have any kind of meaningful interaction with the people around me. The Bible tells me that if I'm a Christian, I'm a child of God. Here's a couple of verses that say that. Firstly, from John's Gospel. John, the writer of that book, says, to all who did receive him, that's Jesus, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And in 1 John chapter 3 verse 1, another letter written to some Christians, it says this: see what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we shall be called children of God, and so we are. The Bible says that our identity as Christians is that we're children of God. And being a child isn't first and foremost an activity, is it? It's an identity. It's who you are. And what more thrilling identity could there possibly be than being a child of God? So if you're a Christian here tonight, I guess one of the challenges that secularism forces us to think through is whether we've actually sort of succumbed to its pressure, whether we've reduced our Christianity to a private matter, whether we've started thinking of it or treating it as something we do and not someone we are. Because it's easy to privatise what I do, but it's not so easy to privatise who I am. And so I think for one way for Christians to fight the tide of secularism is to make our faith about who we are. Not to settle for some sort of impoverished, kind of anemic, half-hearted version that sees my relationship with Jesus as just one more item on a list of things that I do. Maybe that's why we find it such a struggle to be public about our faith, but we need to remember that the gospel changes our identity, and the new identity it gives us is a mind-blowing one. And if you're not a Christian, then maybe what I've just said there gives you some insight into what it means to be a Christian, to have this faith that is so much bigger than a hobby, that gives you a transformed mind and a new identity as one of God's children. Don't think about being a Christian just because you've got a free slot in your schedule on Sunday afternoons, or you like the free food, or you fancy an additional hobby or a top-up to your social life. That would be taking a secularist view of what Christianity is. So that's one way in which the Bible responds to this issue of the privatisation of faith. But what about the personalisation of truth? Well, with that in mind, I want to say this. The gospel makes truth universal, not just personal. Now, we said earlier that secularism makes religious truth personal. It puts questions of truth and morality in the same category as questions of musical preference or favourite ice cream flavours. But the gospel is not ice cream truth. It's iceberg truth. It's big. It's undeniable. And if you hit it, you know about it. Imagine if the passengers on the Titanic had, upon hearing that they'd hit an iceberg, sat down and discussed it in terms of personal opinion. Well, you say we've hit an iceberg, but that's really just what you think. That might be true for you, but the ship that I'm sailing on has hit no icebergs. It'd be ridiculous, wouldn't it? Whether they believed they'd hit an iceberg or not, they had. And the ship was sinking. And denying the fact, or making it just a matter of personal opinion, wouldn't keep them afloat any more than if they tried to stuff the hole with their coats. Look back at that passage in John 18 that we had read for us earlier, and look at what Jesus says at the end of verse 37. He says there, "For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." For Jesus, there is such a thing as universal truth, and he is the witness to that truth. In fact, everyone who is on the side of truth listens to him, the implication being that people who don't follow Jesus are against the truth. They're in the wrong, basically. And elsewhere in John's Gospel, Jesus makes an even more radical claim about this truth. Turn back a few pages in your Bible, if you can, to John chapter 14 and verse 6. It's going to appear on the screen anyway, and I'll read it for you. John 14 verse 6 says this: Jesus said to him, that's Thomas, one of his disciples, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Not only is Jesus the witness to the truth, he actually is the truth. And when it comes to the truth about God, he claims to be the only truth. No one comes to the Father, that is God, except through him. And he's either right or he's wrong, isn't he? And the Christian conviction, and there's plenty of evidence to support it, if it's not something you've looked into, I do encourage you to have a look, is that Jesus is right, that he is the only way to know God. And that makes the truth of the gospel universal, not just personal. But perhaps as Christians, secularism has made us lose confidence in that fact. Perhaps, whilst we wouldn't ever say it, we've slipped into maybe thinking or acting as if the truth that Jesus is the only way to God is just a personal thing. We've started treating it as ice cream truth rather than iceberg truth. We're content to let the world around us respond like Pilate does in John 18 verse 38. You can have a look if you want, where he says with scorn, "What is truth?" If we want to reach a secular world, we need to make faith our identity, not just our activity. And we need to hold on to and proclaim the universal truth of the gospel. That's not to say we ram it down people's throats. That may not necessarily be the best way to win a hearing. But in a secular world, we need to, as Peter tells the readers of his first letter, always be prepared to make a defence to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. We need to defend the truth of our faith. We've really got to hold on to it tightly under the pressure of secularism. If you say to me, "I think truth is just personal," perhaps maybe I need to find a gentle and a loving way to say to you, "Well, that's really just your personal opinion." We're nearly there. Time to look at our final consequence of secularism. In response to the fact that secularism puts man on the throne, I want to say this: the gospel puts God back on the throne. Have another look at that bit of John's gospel that Mark and Lil read for us. Jesus there is confronting the man who is literally on the throne, at least he is over that particular part of the world at that particular time, the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. But have a look at their dialogue in verses 10 and 11 of chapter 19. So Pilate said to Jesus, "You will not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above." You see, Jesus' point is that whilst it looks like Pilate is on the throne, he really isn't. God is. God is the one who rules over human affairs. Last term in church, those of you who were with us will remember, we were looking at the book of Daniel, and we saw God making exactly the same point to the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar. And eventually, Nebuchadnezzar was forced to recognise that the Most High God rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And the same point could be said to those who think that secularism has triumphed. Ultimately, God rules. Attempts to keep him out of the picture, whether that's on a national or on an individual basis, are futile in the long run. And how does God rule? Well, he rules through a king. And who is that king? Well, look back at our reading from John and see what Jesus says to Pilate in verse 36 of chapter 18. Jesus says there, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Jesus is God's king. He rules God's kingdom. And what happens next in John's gospel, as Jesus dies for the sins of the world and rises again from the dead, is his coronation ceremony. John knows it, and he makes sure that his account of Jesus' crucifixion is shot through with reference after ironic reference to Jesus the king. You'll notice that if you look again over that passage that we read, there's just lots and lots of mentions of Jesus as a king. So if you're a Christian here tonight, and maybe you're feeling a bit downhearted because it seems like religion is fighting a losing battle against this overwhelming force of secularism, well, be encouraged. Jesus rules. He rules from everlasting to everlasting. As we were singing earlier, he rules throughout shifts in culture. And the kingdom that he rules is primarily a kingdom of the future, one that's not of this world, but one that will go on forever. And I don't know about you, but that sounds to me very much like a kingdom well worth being part of. You see, secularism puts man on the throne. It says, like the Jewish priests do in John 19 verse 15, "We have no king but Caesar." But the gospel says there is another king, a greater king, and the gospel puts Jesus on the throne. And I guess the question that I want to leave kind of milling around in your minds at the end of this evening is this: bearing in mind that Jesus is on the throne of the universe, who would you rather have on the throne of your life? If I'm honest, when I try and put me on the throne, it turns out that I'm not so great at running my life as I might think. And more seriously, if I put me on the throne, well, I fly in the face of the God who rules the universe. And the Bible tells me that that has consequences. And if you're here tonight and you have decided to put Jesus on the throne, as it were, if you would call yourself a Christian, I guess the challenge that secularism gives us is, well, are we still keeping Jesus on the throne? Are we letting him rule over every bit of our lives? Or are we being like the secularists and saying, no, actually, there's some part of my life that I want to run just for me, that I think I can do a better job doing without reference to God? Now, I don't want to say this evening that we should start a Christian revolution and try and overthrow the secular state. History tells us that Christians are quite as capable of perpetrating inequality and bad government as secularists are. We might even be worse. Plus, we know that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. It's not a secular one. But whilst the theory of secularism and even the process of secularisation has some great aims that we could even support, it has some really critical weaknesses. It's an attempt to keep God, at least in part, out of the picture, and such attempts are always doomed to failure. So let's make sure over the next few weeks, as we try and think about living in a secular world, that we live like that verse that we looked at from Romans 12 earlier. "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind." In a world that's dominated by secularism, let's make the gospel define our identity. Let's stand up for the truth of that gospel. And let's remember that ultimately, God is on the throne. And his kingdom is the one to which we owe our primary allegiance as Christians.